Please the court, good afternoon. My name is Nathan Berger. I represent the plaintiff in the lower court, and that is Michael Leith. We are here, and with me also is co-counsel John Ferris, seated at the appellate's table. I'm asked the court to listen to this case because it's basically, I believe, a question of law that's at issue here. I don't think really any of the facts in this case are disputed. And so the issues that I will address, I think I will focus on the law of the case, the cases, the Colorado cases. The federal cases have been cited, I know, regarding the use of the jury hearing about the failure to file taxes, but there is no Colorado case that I'm aware of that says failure to file income taxes is an example or shows somebody's ability to tell the truth and not tell the truth. The only case involved decided it wasn't, in fact, relevant to truthfulness or untruthfulness, but wasn't overturned because the objector himself raised the issues. And it wasn't harmful error at that time under those circumstances, but there is no Colorado case law that says it is a valid reason to determine somebody's basis for truth, telling the truth or not telling the truth. In the trial, every time that issue was raised, there was an objection, a strenuous objection. The use of failure to file tax returns throughout the case was simply used at every instance to say Mr. Leith is a bad man and shouldn't be here getting any money. There were references to he doesn't file taxes like you and I do. It's a big tax debt, he needs the money. Really irrelevant to the issues in the case, whether there was negligence, whether there were injuries, or whether there were damages. And he's simply to lead the jury to believe he's such a bad man, he shouldn't recover. And our belief is that permeated the whole case and permeated every issue in the case, and it's not an appropriate method to use to show that someone's a bad man for an issue outside any issue involved in the case and bring it up to the jury time after time, opening, closing, and throughout the trial, every opportunity that the defendant had, it was brought up. The other issue is the Allen case, I think, on issues of whether a prior plea of guilty in a DUI case is preclusive on the ability of the defendant then to come in a civil case and testify, no, I wasn't under the influence of alcohol. Although he had full opportunity to do that, was advised of his rights at the DUI trial, and was pled guilty to driving under the influence. That was a key issue in the negligence case. And I know there's cite the case law, although that only relates to convictions. I know there are other cases that have extended to it, the issuance of a citation, traffic citation, but I didn't see any case that referred to a plea of guilty. And that's what we're talking about here, is a plea of guilty after full ability to review the issues before the criminal court then bring it to the civil court and state outright, I wasn't driving under the influence. Although we did get that in the deposition, and I know the trial court referred to that, that was an opportunity to cross-examine the defendant. That doesn't, in our field, I don't see any law in the state of Colorado says you have to stop at that time. If there's another stronger reason to bring up that the defendant is not telling the truth when he says I wasn't driving under the influence, then we should have that opportunity to bring it up and cross-examine the witness on that. Or if there's a concern that that might raise the prejudice or bias the jury somehow, then the Allen case would be more appropriate, where the civil court says, okay, you're stuck with that decision you made. You can't say you weren't driving under the influence. That's a given fact.
And that Councilman, may I interrupt you there, please? But what about the effect of Section 42.4.17.13, that provides no record of the conviction of any person for any violation of this article? shall be admissible as evidence in court in any civil action. Why didn't that, why doesn't that statute preclude you from asking Mr. Byhoffer about his DUI plea?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Number one, just looking at the plain language of the statute, specifically, what does the statute itself say? It says conviction. Doesn't say plea, doesn't say plea of guilty, it says conviction. There was no conviction in this case. This was a plea of guilty where the defendant went in, raised his hand under oath, and said, yes, I was driving under the influence. He didn't fight that and get convicted. The statute itself only applies by its own words to convictions.
But he did get convicted because of his plea, I assume.
Well, that can be treated as a conviction. And I know under the criminal code, they say any plea of guilty will be treated for sentencing purposes as a conviction. But then there are other rules and statutes that allow cross-examination of the defendant who comes in and testifies other than to what he admitted occurred at the time. And that Rule 410, for example, is Colorado Rule of Evidence 410, specifically allows, except as otherwise provided by statute, that you can use anything other than a nolo contendere plea, but it doesn't exclude a plea of guilty. That statute specifically, the 410, is there to allow a plea of guilty to come in for cross-examination purposes. And in the cases I cited where a defendant testified he didn't commit the crime or didn't do the act or didn't do something wrong, was allowed to come in on several cases when the defendant specifically denies that issue. They don't allow the statute, the for basically traffic infractions, is what I think that statute was for. And they don't allow that statute to permit the defendant to come in and lie or make misstatements about whatever they want under the protection of that statute. I think the statute was there really for traffic infractions, and you go and plead to a careless or something where there's no jail time involved. But in this case, this was a misdemeanor. This was a DUI, and it's not what I would characterize as a minor offense to go out and get stoned and hit somebody and injure somebody.
I'm sorry. Is there anything in the statute that suggests, though, that DUIs should be exempted from those provisions?
No, the statute is 1703, and I believe it does preclude any evidence of a conviction under the violation of DUIs included in that area that is available. But the issue is when the defendant comes in and testifies otherwise, not to use it, we didn't ask to come in and use it to prove that he was under the influence. You wanted to use it to impeach him, to come in and say, no, he's not telling the truth. We would agree with bringing it in as a substantive evidence.
Didn't you impeach him through the use of his deposition, in which he admitted that he was driving under the influence of drugs?
Yes, we did get the one chance there to impeach him for that purpose. That was available, and we did use it, but that was, I believe, of minimal influence, and we shouldn't be limited to only that if there's other evidence there. If the defendant gets up and does contradict that, there is no basis to limit our ability to ask questions that would impeach the witness. It's if there was some limit, then perhaps yes, and that would be a basis to do it. It's direct. This was all of the trial court called it direct impeachment. I think it was more indirect. When I call it direct impeachment, was when you look at someone and say, you're a bad person, and directly impeach their character. Indirect impeachment I look at as, well, you testify otherwise in another case, and that's what this was. I believe this was indirect impeachment because he testified in the prior DUI case that he was under the influence.
So, and I apologize for interrupting you, but it sounds as though you're suggesting that perhaps it's bad policy to have this statute which precludes DUIs from being admitted into evidence under the circumstance that you're asking here, But isn't that a matter that's for the legislature then to determine and to fix as opposed to our resolving that?
Yes, I believe that issue is up to the legislature. But that's not really the issue, even if I disagree with it. But I don't disagree with the policy behind that statute. I just don't think the statute was intended to limit your ability to cross-examine and impeach a witness. I think the purpose of the statute was to limit its use, to come in and use it as evidence in your case in chief to prove something happened. This is more impeachment of the witness testifying, not to show a substantive instance of fact is what we're asking to have that applied to.
Counsel, I just want to be clear. The very first argument in your brief is that the court should have given preclusive effect to the guilty plea. Are you abandoning that argument today? It sounds like you are.
Well, no, I'm trying to address what was raised in the answer brief, but no, we aren't. I believe that would have resolved any issue of bias as a result of that. I think that the answer brief really says big case should be treated differently from a little case. And I don't know of any reason for that, that the size of the case should make any difference of whether the preclusive effect is valid. I think the policies are all the same. It looks funny to have conviction for DUI in one case and another case say no issue with DUI. There was no negligence or no problem with the DUI.
But I understood you to say you weren't seeking to admit it as substantive evidence, but that's what giving it preclusive effect is.
Well, then I would be wrong. My thought was that would avoid bringing it out as impeachment. But yes, that would hold the defendant to what was prior admitted. And I didn't look at it as substantive, more as a procedural type of issue where the defendant is not allowed to state contrary to his prior admission in another case before a court of law that he's bound by that statement. And the other issues are going by a lot faster, and I appreciate the questions. I sat here with no questions, I wondered what I was doing wrong. The again, the tenet in jury instruction, we feel, was entitled to at least have the jury instruction. What is DUI? Basis for that is most people, I believe, when they hear DUI, think alcohol. And we were entitled to at least have the instruction that says it could be drugs also. And the medical testimony, I think we argued that fairly thoroughly in the opening brief and the closing and the reply brief. But that, again, although we think that is available to preserve that issue, that seems to be what the answer brief said, I think was preserved by our motion in limine. I don't believe we needed any other thing to preserve that issue. It was raised at an appropriate time. The district court had all the time needed to review that and file motion after motion on it. That issue was obviously preserved for appeal here today. And we believe that although the court can limit discovery, that there is no court that can say, okay, you can't have medical treatment. The medical treatment continues. It pursues. If we get a report from the doctors later on, it's appropriate for us to submit it. And if there's an issue with it, there should be a Todd hearing. And there was no Todd hearing. We argued the issues. The defendant argued the issues. The court didn't address a single Todd issue, and we think that's where the error occurred.
May I ask you another question, then?
Yes.
Related to that, in your brief, you argue that the court should have applied Todd, and that was basically part of its error that it did not. In its order, dated March 1st, 2013. This was the order regarding the motion in limine. Does that not address ultimately the issues that Todd requires the court to address, saying whether it was substantially justified for the late discovery?
No, I didn't see any issues specifically addressed. The order was short and didn't leave a lot of, I didn't see any time issues addressed in any of the district court's orders. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the last 30 seconds for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good afternoon. Bradlaugh Shannon, registration 15220, represent Peter Myonker. What I want to talk to you about is, first of all, the path of least resistance in this appeal, and then I want to address the four appellate issues that the plaintiff has raised. The path of least resistance is that take all the plaintiff's arguments and they're harmless. This was a case about causation. This was a minor car accident. It was a 5 mile per hour at best, rear end car accident, in which my client's car slid on ice into the, my client was driving a Saab, slid into the Crown Vic driven by the plaintiff. Absolutely no damage to my client's car. There were scratches to the plaintiff's car. Officer Bostrak from Boulder Police Department testified that there were no injuries reported at the scene. There was no medical care for 9 days. There was no chiropractic treatment didn't start until 2 months after the accident. The jury returned a verdict finding against the plaintiff on all three elements that the plaintiff had to prove: negligence, causation, and damages. The plaintiff has now argued to this court that the trial court erred on two issues of negligence and two issues on damages. Plaintiff does not bring up any alleged arguments regarding causation. So even if this court, well, to grant a trial, this court would have to find that there is both an error in the negligence element and a damages element for the Court of Appeals, I believe, to grant a new trial. Even if that was the case, we still are left with the fact that the jury found, and there's no argument on that finding, that this minor accident did not cause the claimed injuries and damages.
Well, so, but isn't the argument or the issue relating to the impeachment with the tax return evidence, that went to credibility generally, it seems to me. And since it went to credibility generally, that could impact the causation because, of course, Mr. Leaf testifies to causation.
It did go to credibility, certainly. To take one piece of evidence, though, and to apply it to causation, I don't believe was argued by the plaintiff, and I think would be a stretch. I think that the court obviously has to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, and even if the court found that piece of evidence should have been allowed, based on all the other evidence in this case, some of which I've cited, I don't believe that this court can find that the plaintiff has met their burden of proving that error was so harmful to allow them to have a new trial on all three issues.
Counsel, is it your view that the statute that we were talking about earlier bars even evidence used to impeach testimony?
Yes.
Why is that?
The statute, I think it's clear. It's broad and it's clear. It indicates that the evidence of a traffic conviction, and a plea bargain, of course, is a traffic conviction, is not to be used in a civil trial. If it wanted to carve out exceptions, the legislature would have done that. If it wanted to allow certain uses for that type of evidence, the legislature would have done that.
But we don't ordinarily construe statutes to shield evidence of perjury, do we?
Well, there was no perjury.
Well, I'm just saying, the contention is he testified falsely, okay, and that this evidence would have impeached that. He testified it wasn't under the influence, okay?
At the time of the
accident. All right, so you're saying that evidence used as impeachment to show that the witness was testifying falsely is not admissible. That's pretty far.
Well, the keep in mind that the statute is precluding evidence regarding a traffic conviction. Most traffic convictions are based on plea bargains. Most plea bargains, not all, but many plea bargains have many factors as to why they're entered into. Most people, honestly, in a traffic conviction don't want to take the time to fight. And so the evidence is to preclude that information. There was no perjury here. The testimony by Mr. Beihoffer was that he took two Xanax shortly before getting in the car and driving 2.5 blocks when the accident occurred. And he testified that he didn't believe when he was driving that he was intoxicated.
But did he testify differently in his deposition?
He did.
And so, so he was right both times?
No, I mean, you have witnesses who sometimes give inconsistent testimony, and that's what we deal with at the trial court.
Well, isn't that precisely why the plaintiff wanted to get into the fact that he admitted to the DUI, because the DUI was that he in fact was driving at a point in time where he was under the influence, whereas that was specifically what he was denying during the civil trial. He was basically saying, well, I wasn't under the influence until later, at the point in time when I had the roadsides. At the time that I was driving and struck Mr. Leaf's car, I wasn't under the influence. So it seems contradictory.
Well, the statute precludes evidence of the conviction and of the plea bargain. So by allowing cross-examination on the plea bargain and thus conviction, opens up the can of worms as, okay, why did you plead to this?
So could the plaintiffs then have asked, is it true that you have admitted in a court of law that you were driving under the influence at the time of the accident?
I don't think so. That's an issue that wasn't raised in the trial court and hasn't been raised in the briefs. But I think that the statute is broad, and it keeps out evidence in traffic cases having anything to do with the plea bargain and conviction in that traffic case. I think that's what the legislature has clearly intended by the language of the statute, and there are no exceptions to that. So my answer, I think, is that no, they probably could not have done that if they had wanted to, or if they had presented that scenario. The plaintiff, one more thing on that element, you know, the plaintiff argues the Allen case, and the Allen case, of course, was a complex securities fraud case in which one of the statutes was a felony, obviously different from our case, but specifically the Court of Appeals in that 2008 case also talked about the fact that an element of issue preclusion is whether the party resisting preclusion had sufficient incentive to vigorously litigate the issues. And that's, I think, perhaps behind, I'm not going to get into intent, but that's consistent with what this statute 42417.13 is about, that people in traffic cases don't have an incentive to vigorously litigate the issues.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the tax return issue. Go back to that.
Yes.
I know you're familiar with the Kramer case. In the Kramer case, the division appears to have assumed, it's a little hard to tell, that the evidence of the failure to file a tax return was not admissible under 608B. How do you distinguish that case?
Well, I think it is a bit unclear. As I understand and I interpret the case is that if there's a showing that there's an intentional failure to file income tax returns, that would be admissible under 608B. And in Kramer, there was a one-time missed income tax return. Here we have 7 years, 2006 to 2012. There was absolutely no explanation given by the plaintiff at any time as to why he failed to file income tax returns for those 7 years. It's clear that he was aware that he had to file the income tax returns by the time of trial. He had taken the steps, at least he told the jury, he had taken the steps to go back and file these income tax returns, which he acknowledged were something that he had to do. So you have 7 years of, by strong and reasonable inference, of an intentional failure to file income tax returns. And I think that's what people v. Kramer contemplates as allowing evidence under 608B to question about the failure to file income tax returns. The plaintiff, their second argument was that the court rejected a jury instruction, which was a definition of DUI. Really, the Supreme Court notes on use are clear on that, that definitions just can't be thrown out there. They have to be tied to some element. There was no negligence per se in this case. If you went to trial, court properly rejected that definition when it wasn't tied to anything. The last argument that they had, which was the third in the brief, was that the trial court was wrong in precluding the February 20, 2013 MRI. The timing we set forth in our brief, but briefly, the timing was that after the trial court continued the case and essentially froze discovery and new evidence, there was no objection by the plaintiff. There was no indication at that time that there would be ongoing treatment. The deposition of the witness, Dr. Margaret Cerrone, was set. After the deposition was set, then the plaintiff went and got this MRI. The MRI was MRI of America, in which Dr. Sloan was employed. There was no indication, no disclosure of any testimony that the MRI was for treatment purposes. There was also no indication or no disclosure of any testimony that any findings on the MRI were caused by the car accident. The trial court, trial courts are under a lot of pressure by the Supreme Court to get cases tried. And we hear that all the time as trial lawyers. And there's the case law, of course, is that trial courts have a right to reasonably manage their docket. And that's exactly what the two judges on this case were doing when they precluded that additional evidence of the MRI.
May I ask you, how do you distinguish Todd from this circumstance?
Well, first of all, I think that the court's order, while perhaps not as articulate as we would like, contemplated Todd and the factors of Todd.
The order that I was referencing yes. earlier?
Yes. I think that there was a finding and an order that was consistent with the fact that the untimeliness of the disclosure was not harmless, that plaintiff has to prove it was not harmless, and that it was not substantially justified. And so I'm not sure if it really requires a distinction. I think that the trial court properly looked at the circumstances in this case. Here we had an MRI, a new technology, MRI, on the website, it talked about this new technology. It was not a recumbent MRI, but a sitting or a standing MRI with motion, which is new technology. That was disclosed for the first time 7 days before trial testimony, because Dr. Searle's deposition was being taken for trial purposes. Obviously, we had little time to do anything, little time to research this new technology, little time to retain a radiologist to consult with, no time actually to disclose our own radiologist, and the timing was certainly not harmless to us. And the substantial justification, at the trial court level, there was no justification. There was no argument. I know now the argument is that this was part of ongoing treatment. That was not an argument at the trial court level. It's one that I don't think can be raised now. The substantial justification element also was the fact that MRI was set long after the last disclosed treatment, set even after the deposition of Dr. Cerrone, and there was no real, there's never any attempt at really justifying why the disclosure was so late. So I think that the court's order is entirely consistent with following the elements of the Todd versus Bear Valley, and certainly with Rule 37.
Do I understand you to say then that you think Todd is applicable, but the court met the requirements?
Yeah, I think Todd, Rule 37 and Todd, I think, are the prevailing standards and the factors that courts have to look at. In in managing their docket with the Supreme Court mandate of getting cases tried. That's what these judges in Boulder County, I believe, did. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Berger, you have 31 seconds.
New technology is the only statement by counsel. Doesn't appear anywhere in the record. No experts said that. We asked for a continuance. There have been no continuances asked for at any time before by the plaintiff, and the trial court denied that. That would appear to be any bias or prejudice. And the tax returns permeate the whole case. That, although it seems small, is one of the key issues even used here today to this court, mentioning six or seven times. Of course, that's a bad person. That looks like a bad person. Didn't belong in this case and should have been used to influence the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And I wish to thank both of you for your arguments. The arguments will be helpful to the court in reaching an opinion. And the matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will be issued in due course.
Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our docket today. Counsel are excused, and the court will be in recess and available may so announce.